From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2015 when Iran struck a deal with a group of world powers to create what is now known roughly as the Iran nuclear deal. And it has been hotly debated since those early negotiations. As you probably know, it has become very much a political issue. President Trump was critical of the deal during the campaign. And in recent weeks, Trump has continued to press his desire to essentially scrap the agreement. But the New York Times reported in August that world nuclear inspectors had contradicted Trump's claim that Iran is not adhering to the rules. The Times wrote, quote, inspectors complicated President Trump's effort to find Iran in violation of the two-year-old nuclear accord with the United States and five other world powers, declaring that the latest inspections found no evidence that Iran is breaching the agreement. Mr. Trump has made no secret of his desire to scrap the agreement, even over the objections of many of his top national security officials. But the reports of the International Atomic Energy Agency make it harder to create an argument that Iran is in violation. End quote. And so here is a vital question. What happens if international inspectors give Iran the thumbs up, but the Trump White House declares Iran in violation anyway? What happens to the deal? How would it impact the region and peace efforts? And can we trust that Iran is, in fact, in compliance? One of the most experienced voices in the world on this matter is Ambassador Thomas Pickering. He has served our country in many high-ranking roles, including as ambassador to the United Nations, ambassador to Israel, ambassador to Russia, and Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. He is in Rochester, and he continues to work on international diplomatic efforts in many ways today. He is speaking at 3 p.m. today, and it is a free public event. It's in the Feldman Ballroom at the Frederick Douglass Commons at the University of Rochester, and he's going to be talking about the Iran nuclear agreement. So 3 p.m. with Ambassador Pickering today, if you want to attend. But right now, he's kind enough to spend this hour with us on Connections. And Ambassador, it is my honor. Thank you for being here.
Evan, I'm pleased to be here, and thank you very much. And maybe I could say, as you know, I have worked closely with something called the Iran Project.
Yeah.
And the Iran Project has brought me here. And it was something that began back in 2001. A group of former diplomats who thought we should have contacts with Iran because otherwise we were heading into deep difficulty and that diplomatic contacts could help solve problems. It took 16 years for that to come to fruition, but I think we were right in the long run, and I'm pleased and honored to be with you today, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, and so the Iran Project, again, that goes back to 2001, is comprised, as you said, of many diplomats. Any political bent or ideology that you
would describe? We've scrupulously avoided that, and we have produced a number of public statements in which we get between 40 and 120 people, and we seek people from all parties, from all points of view, and from all sides.
And so as you saw the agreement starting to progress with Iran, especially in the spring of 2015 on those negotiations, I know you had some contact with those who were helping create the architecture for that deal. Tell me about that.
Well, it was part of our conversations with the Iranians in Track 2, which means unofficial people speaking to each other in lieu of governments, but keeping governments informed. And we kept the U.S. government informed, the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, both before and after our contacts. And so it was normal for us to go by and see our old friends working in government, in the State Department, in the National Security Council, out at Langley in the Central Intelligence Agency. Tell them what we were hearing, and they were interested because it represented another window into Iran. And we told them what we were thinking about. For example, at the very beginning, we thought that the U.S. position of seeking zero enrichment, while it would facilitate the monitoring of an agreement, went too far, and it didn't have to happen that way, and that limited enrichment could be carefully monitored by inspection and control. And we advocated that along with a number of other people, and it became the U.S. position, and that position was instrumental in solving the problem.
When it comes to limited enrichment, forgive me, but is this that distinction that Iran might want nuclear enrichment for nuclear power, for energy purposes, but not for weaponry purposes?
Yes, for medical purposes and for nuclear power production purposes and so on, it's perfectly legitimate for countries to engage in enrichment for those purposes. But it required, in our view, something that had not appeared in the international world before, a commitment by the country to stay at a certain level of enrichment, precisely 3.67% in the isotope 235, which is the fissionable isotope. And normally, we think that above 40%, up in the neighborhood of 60 to 80%, is what's needed for nuclear weapons. So the distinction is important. And also the volume of material is important, because even at a low enrichment, a large volume of low-enriched material can be upgraded very quickly. It is the first several percent that takes the most time and energy in enrichment.
Interesting. And so not all enrichment is the same. And how was Iran when it comes to how receptive they were to this idea that they would have a limit to how much they could enrich?
They saw it as a step forward over zero enrichment, which they had in 2002 accepted and which lasted 2 years, but they did not achieve, as a result of the discussions then, the objectives they wanted, which was an agreement on partial enrichment. And so they abrogated the 2-year moratorium, and that set things back a long way. And it took quite a long while for the parties to come back to the idea that a successful agreement could be based on limited enrichment by Iran, as long as it was accompanied by extensive and very importantly administered inspection. And the deal has several brand new ways of inspecting that are critically useful and could become the beginning of a standard for the whole world in the future of enrichment. And this in itself might be a way of improving the Iran agreement by applying it to everybody and bringing everybody on board using those principles.
There was a leader that you probably knew well who said, trust but verify. When it comes to the verification process, as you say, if this is going to be successful, why can we trust it? Why did you feel comfortable with that kind of framework?
I felt, because of my long experience, that this was a suitable way to deal with a very difficult problem, and that what additionally we were asking for was not so important that it should negate our capacity to stop any progress of Iran toward a nuclear weapon soon.
So now, here we are in 2017. We knew it would be an issue in the political campaign, and it was. And are you disappointed to see it? Let me back up and say, do you think it was politicized, or do you think there were legitimate criticisms that came up in the campaign?
It was politicized, in my humble view, because we heard a great deal about tearing up, but nothing other than it was the world's worst deal. There were several other world's worst deals, so I'm not sure where it fit in the spectrum. But we heard nothing but it was the world's worst deal, but very few concerns. One concern that was expressed by President Trump, that $150 billion would be given to Iran. The truth is that it was $150 billion of Iran's money that was locked up by sanctions, and that it only would go to Iran so long as Iran complied with the deal. And it was not our money to give away.
Listeners, if you want to call the program, we've got Ambassador Thomas Pickering, a great opportunity for you to check in and join the conversation with someone with a tremendous and vast experience. He's in Rochester today, speaking at the University of Rochester at 3 p.m. this afternoon. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Ambassador Pickering is part of the Iran Project. You can find more about their views on these issues at theiranproject.org. And so let me also ask you a question that, I think it matters to a large extent that we try to at least understand how the Iranian people view this. And here's what I kind of wonder, Ambassador. Is there a view in the Iranian street, so to speak, and I know we're speaking very generally now, that the international community, of which, of course, the United States is a part with this deal, is trying to, quote, tell them what to do with power, that they're stripping autonomy away? Or is there a feeling that the deal had fairness and some acceptance in Iran?
I think somewhat more the latter than the former, with the people who we have been meeting with in Iran for 16 years and who we know well, and who all have different views about the deal themselves. But the notion that the people in the street have gotten beginning of the benefits of removing the sanctions, which has helped to open up their economy, much too slowly for them. And people do not know that U.S. sanctions on trade with Iran have not been taken off in the deal, much as they tell us that they believe that they have been. So it is the slowness, but nevertheless the inexorable progress toward taking sanctions relief off that has helped the Iranian public understand that the deal has benefits for them, too. They also are quite firm up and down in Iran and saying they did not want to build a nuclear weapon. They do not want to. So, in effect, taking away that possibility and complaining about it is what I would call an argument against interest here. And so they don't.
Ambassador, I'm also curious to know how you feel about, and if you have some frustration about, public understanding or lack of understanding of a deal like this. I understand that the terms are going to be complex, that they are negotiated carefully, that the media is going to report sort of the broad outlines of it. I mean, that I understand. But as you mentioned, this idea of $150 billion going to Iran, we had stories of suitcases of money and pictures of showing up, you know, this clandestine meeting, and here's what the Obama administration didn't want you to see. Misreported in many, many ways. Sanctions misreported. You know, why do you think we have such poor, I don't want to say public understanding. Are we almost willfully ignorant? Does it become partisan? Do we latch on to anything that would sort of scuttle this deal if it was made by the political party we don't like? Or is there a way for us to have better civics understanding of this?
Evan, given the polarization that exists, particularly in Washington and among members of Congress from both parties, it would be hard for me to tell you that polarization has not played some role in the differing views in this agreement. But there were some Democrats who didn't like the agreement. I think many who were in sympathy with Israel. And it's an absolutely fascinating piece of news today that a high official in the government of the United States has released the views that both the Israeli government and the Saudi government have urged the United States not to break the agreement by tearing it up.
So here we are, and we're talking to Ambassador Pickering about what would happen in that way. And you go, well, you wonder why would this agreement be scrapped if, as the New York Times reports, international inspectors in recent inspections have said Iran is in compliance. President Trump has said otherwise. I think his ambassador to the United Nations is trying to kind of split the difference a little bit and deal with that delicate dance, which we'll talk about more in a moment. But does it matter, Ambassador? If President Trump says they're not in compliance, but IAEA says, yes, they are we putting the deal itself in jeopardy with the president continuing to press the idea that Iran has broken this?
Let me try to be careful in explaining this. It's a critically important question, and it'll be the centerpiece leading up to October 15th when the president has to make a finding. The president literally has to sign a paper or get the secretary, approve the Secretary of State signing a paper that waives the continuation of U.S. sanctions against Iran in connection with the nuclear deal. And we are committed in the agreement with Iran, as long as Iran complies with the deal, to continue to waive the application of those specific sanctions and not to reconstruct them in a different guise. So the president doesn't have to sign. He doesn't literally have to find the question of compliance. But if he fails to waive the sanctions and everybody else believes Iran is in compliance, then it's quite clear we have violated the deal. And then there are two results from that. One is Iran could feel free, at least with respect to the United States, to go back to enriching uranium. And doing it rapidly and at higher levels, which was what they were doing before the deal stopped them from doing it. Or they could say, well, the hell with the United States. We're going to make this deal because it's with five other countries, a continuing set of our relationships there, and we will do everything we can to isolate and marginalize and minimize the United States.
In which case, our authority and leadership position in the world would be jeopardized, would it not?
It would be, but there would be other consequences of that marginalization of our leadership position. We would have less capacity to be influential, in my view, on important settlements in the Middle East, Syria, Israel, Palestine, and others. We would be separated in that regard from our major role in the international community. But even more importantly, if we then sought to compel others to comply by threatening them with the idea that if they do business with Iran, they will not be allowed to do business in dollars with the United States, which we could do. But that then puts our reserve currency of the world under the threat of being replaced. And increasingly, countries over the years said, why should we let the United States use its currency as a political weapon by keeping us out of doing trade with the United States if we don't do what the United States likes in a case like Iran, where the United States would have palpably and clearly violated the agreement? And so that would put at jeopardy the continuing importance to us of, in fact, being the world leader in the financial world and everything passing through the United States and New York, the financial capital, and all the things that you can think of here that would affect everything, including jobs.
So, listeners, I want to make sure it's important that we understand, because this was rather new to me today as someone who's tried to follow from afar the Iran nuclear deal. The question for months has been, well, is Iran complying? What the ambassador is saying is, if Iran is in fact, according to inspectors, complying, and we are continuing to claim that they are not, we are the ones who are not complying.
That's right.
And there are possible serious consequences for that. Now, Ambassador Haley hasn't always, I don't think that she is directly rebuking or contradicting the president, but we've seen Rex Tillerson, we've seen Jim Mattis and others occasionally walk back, whether it was the president's comments about NATO and about articles of protection. And you know, there's been a lot of moments where his cabinet has occasionally seemed to soften the idea of something that he has presented to the public. How do you view Ambassador Haley's role there, and is that a delicate job for her?
Yes, it is. But rather than to do what you have just outlined, she gave a speech roughly a week ago at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, and it's worth reading. It's a carefully crafted speech, but in my view, it is full of exaggerations leading to misimpression. I won't use the word L-I-E.
Okay.
I'm a diplomat.
I see.
So, what she has said is for the president can find that there is contravention of this agreement by Iran doing things they're not required to do in the agreement. So ballistic missile testing, which is not covered by the agreement, it covers nuclear only, for good reason, because we did not feel that we could combine both and get the deal we needed on nuclear. And she also has said U.S. legislation, which requires some things, requires that the president find them in contravention if, in fact, they do things that are not in any way at all they are required to do under the agreement. This is complicated. And then she has said what the president would do is fail to waive continuation of no sanctions on Iran, and fail to waive and therefore hold back any further sanctions, and then throw it to the Congress. And she said, and I'm not sure the basis for this, the Congress then has 60 days to act. So she's putting the president in a neutral position and putting it all on the back of the Congress, which is really pulling the president's chestnuts out of the fire, but in a way that does not escape all the consequences I just outlined with you on what would happen if we violate the agreement, because it would still be seen, as the other parties were quite sure, as a violation of the agreement. They have said so.
Could Ambassador Haley say, look, you might say, you might argue that ballistic missiles or any number of things is not technically in the language of the agreement, but Iran's actions violate the spirit of the agreement, that we have some discretion to make that determination?
With international treaties, we're bound by the letter. And in fact, we could go to the International Court to settle a problem of interpretation rather than merely to make up a story that says there is something called the spirit of the agreement and Iran is not keeping it and we are. That would be the way that that kind of a problem would play out were we willing to go to the international court to fight it through. But I suspect given the political dynamics behind this, there's still a large piece of effort to move. What I just said about Israeli advice and Saudi advice, if indeed it proves to be true, and the source looks pretty good on this, is important because it gives the president another reason not to do something that I think he thought was important to get elected, but after election could spell some kind of serious disaster. Look at the possibilities that if things with Iran decline, and we get involved in accidental problems in the Gulf with our navies. Do we go to war? Is another war in the region something the public in the United States really wants? I think the president is wise enough to know, because he said so in the campaign, that he wasn't going to get into another war. And moving in a path that would take us there is something we should seriously avoid.
Just as from my observation of this president, I appreciate the language that says a war in that region is not necessarily in our best interest. We shouldn't be seeking it. I also see him—
You're turning into a diplomat, Evan.
Yeah, yeah.
tell him it's just a lousy idea.
Yeah. But I also see in him a bit of impulsiveness that we didn't necessarily see in his predecessors, regardless of party. And I'm wondering if that internal conflict, would be occasionally won over by something impulsive, if there is a naval incident, if there is something that could spark it. Do you have those same fears?
I do, and I have particularly those fears about North Korea, where we seem to be in a kind of international game of chicken, with Trump behind the wheel of one car headed down the road and Kim Jong-un behind the wheel of the other, headed directly at each other, waiting to see who flinches. And my view is that's a problem where it is important to bring pressure on Kim Jong-un, but it is also important to do what we did in Iran, open the door to diplomacy, because there are things that can be done in that arrangement quite parallel to what we did with Iran that I think can begin the process of heading it off, however much we feel, and I do, Kim Jong-un is a tougher customer.
Yeah, this is one of those cases where this is the classic Trump team giving different ideas. Trump, of course, did the really bellicose comments about, you know, fire and fury, like the likes of which were. It was a clear implication that we would go to nuclear war with North Korea if we had to. Then you had Jim Mattis and others essentially taking that off the table. You had Steve Bannon giving an interview that was ostensibly he didn't know was on the record, saying that North Korea has us in a box because we can't go to war with them, and so you had all these conflicting messages. I don't know if there was some genius here that it was for a point, or if it was really that much disarray. But Ambassador, how do you talk to the public about North Korea in a way that says we're not looking for, and you know, we're not going to be going into a nuclear war here? Because I think Steve Bannon might have been right to say they kind of got us here. Are we going to war with a nuclear power like North Korea that's unpredictable, or maybe it's not? How do you kind of practice diplomacy while at the same time not seeming to take militarism off the table, even if you sort of have internally? That's got to be very difficult.
It's very important, Evan. Two things that I would mention: Secretary Tillerson has very early on continued to make the point that's in the press that we do not seek regime change in North Korea. And that's prevailed. I mean, there is nobody has come in and said, no, we're off to regime change. I suspect the North Koreans don't believe it. On the other hand, over the years, the North Koreans said America is perpetually, inevitably hostile to them, and that's the reason they have to have this nuclear weapon. And they have begun at times, but only tangentially, to hint that if the hostility could be ended, the problem of the weapon might be taken care of. We don't know what that means, and it's an uncertain piece. But it shows you, in fact, that as you increase military pressure, you have got to shape the door through which you want them to walk. Otherwise, you're going to wait until something drops in your lap from the tree, like a ripe plum, and that may not be what you want. So diplomacy has to play a role fairly early in shaping the course of events, and I think there are people in the administration who understand that, but we're not there because the other argument is if you open the door too early to diplomacy, you, quote, show weakness. I don't believe that. It's what you agree to in diplomacy that shows strength or weakness. But it is an argument that's out there. And with a strong dominance of American policy by the military, there has been a typical long-term distrust of diplomacy. They see it potentially as undoing what they have done, or they see it as a way of compromising when, in fact, the military are trained to produce victory about which there can be no compromises. So we have to begin to talk to each other more, military and civilians, to work our way through this. And I think people understand this, but the question of doing something and the timing for doing that is acutely sensitive. And so just as if President Trump threw away the Iran agreement, and then we have to go to North Korea for an agreement, what are they going to think? Is diplomacy an American trick and that we're going to throw away every deal we make because they can't be trusted? Is that the kind of approach we want to take? So the two, I raised North Korea and you did because the two play off against each other.
So if, again, with the ambassador telling us, if we scuttle the Iran deal and the rest of the world powers involved in that agreement disagree with our assessment, we are jeopardizing the credibility of existing agreements and possible future deals.
And the possible role of diplomacy in solving the problem. And now another question here is, we have not used military force against Korea because Korea over the years has put in tunnels, thousands of artillery pieces that have the capacity to strike the northern portion of Seoul, Korea, the capital of the Republic of Korea. And so that's put us under a threat that is in some ways more realistic than some potential nuclear threat from a bomb that has been tested, but we are not certain yet that it's deliverable.
Talking to Ambassador Thomas Pickering, and listeners, if you're just joining us, Ambassador Pickering is among the most distinguished guests we've ever had on this program. He was the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, served as Ambassador to Israel, to Russia. He was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, and that is just part of his resume. He's with the Iran Project, theiranproject.org, to learn more. And Ambassador Pickering is giving a public presentation on the Iran deal this afternoon, 3 p.m. at the University of Rochester. It's in the Feldman Ballroom in the Frederick Douglass Commons. 3 p.m. at the University of Rochester today, a tremendous opportunity to listen to Ambassador Pickering on this subject and to meet one of the diplomatic leaders in world affairs going back decades now. We're going to get our only break of the hour. We can come back to some of your questions and comments if you have them. We'll check your emails, connections at WXXI.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. We are right back with Ambassador Pickering. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, author Heather Ann Thompson joins us. Her book on the Attica Uprising of 1971 won the Pulitzer Prize for History. She joins us in studio. First hour. In our second hour, is it possible to grow meat in a lab? More investors think the answer is yes, and an answer to the environmental damage caused by animal-based agriculture. We'll explore it. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Just a brief programming note. We podcast all of our programs, WXXINews.org/connections, if you want to share them with others or go back and you missed any of the conversations we have on this broadcast. Now, typically 9 to 11 p.m., we rebroadcast the show, but tonight We're going to be preempting because it's primary day here in Rochester and Western New York. The polls opened at noon. They are open until 9 p.m. tonight. And then at 9 p.m. when the polls close, we will come on the air live for 2 hours with primary coverage. We, of course, have races around our region, a lot of focus on the city of Rochester with a three-way Democratic mayoral primary happening today, city council, school board, and more. So join us for live coverage 9 to 11 tonight on WXXI for primary coverage. Let's get some of your phone calls and comments in. This is John in Rochester. I'm with Ambassador Thomas Pickering. Go ahead, John. Hi, John. Are you there? Stay there for a second, John.
I'm here.
There you go, sir. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Great. Hi, Ambassador. Ambassador, how would you compare the North Korean deal that Clinton did with the one in Iran? The reason I bring it up is I remember vividly when Bill Clinton said, after the deal was done, this will guarantee North Korea will never get nuclear weapons. What are your thoughts on that deal versus this deal?
John, thanks. The North Korean deal that was made back in the early part of the Clinton administration dealt solely with plutonium as one of the two sources of fissile material for use in nuclear weapons. And it shut down a reactor, and it did a number of things to undo the reactor. In return, because we believed that North Korea was only working on plutonium, the president had some reason to be confident that it stopped the path. In truth, probably through cooperation with Pakistan, North Korea got access to uranium enrichment and was moving down that path, something we didn't discover until the George W. Bush administration. But at the same time, there was very strong opposition to that deal on the other party's side in Congress. And to some extent, they held up our compliance with part of that deal, including the provision to North Korea first of heavy fuel oil to make electricity, and then later in a Japanese and South Korean effort to fund and provide two civilian power reactors to North Korea in order to remove any justification they had of creating a nuclear power program and changing it into a military one, which is something we thought was going on. That's complex, but it meant, in fact, that there was fault on both sides in that deal that led to its undoing. We now face a similar problem in Iran if the president were to find that Iran was in violation, but the international community, including all of the intelligence resources and probably U.S. intelligence resources, all agreed that they were in compliance. And that would put us in the wrong, I think unnecessarily, rather than to keep the heat and the pressure on the Iranians to comply.
Do you think President Obama made a mistake with this deal? And the second part of that, Have we funded, supposedly we're going to give North Iran $150 billion. Has that all been funded?
I'm glad you asked that question. I don't believe essentially President Obama made a mistake. I think that the one thing that I think I would correct in the deal if I could, and actually I've presented an article in a journal to do that, is to have the agreement extended in time beyond the 13 years that critically limit Iran's enrichment of nuclear material. And so I think that's an important way to go ahead. And my own view is the deal is a good deal. And I've been associated in the efforts to look for this deal for 16 years. And in the end, we did better than I thought we could do in bringing about an arrangement that at least for the next 12 or 11 years makes it very hard for Iran to get out of the deal. On the $150 billion, that's Iran's money. It's money that was, in a sense, confiscated in banks as a result of the sanctions. We agreed that we would lift the sanctions in order to get this deal. So Iran got back its own money. They got no money from us with respect to this particular piece of information, despite the fact that you've got press seemingly reporting it that way.
Well, I think it was. I think there's a lot of people like me that think it was a huge mistake. I thought the sanctions that were working, if we would have tightened the noose on Iran, they're funding Hezbollah as we speak. They're a horrible terrorist funder.
John, let me just say, I understand exactly what you say, and the deal was not designed to end Iran's support for terrorism or Iran's role in the Middle East, much as we would have liked to. And there's a good reason for that, because if we had tried to achieve all those objectives, many of us believe that we would have to lighten up and ease up on the nuclear stuff. That was the way it was working. Secondly, tightening up on sanctions means that we would have to get the rest of the international community, because our trade with Iran was minimal. Our effort to influence Iran through sanctions without bringing all the other players who were in fact trading with Iran into the deal was limited. And it's important for us to remember that this deal was got because the five permanent members of the UN Security Council in Germany hung tough in getting the essential elements of this deal.
Ambassador Thomas Pickering, my guest in studio today. He's visiting Rochester and giving a public presentation on the Iran deal at 3 p.m. at the University of Rochester. He's part of a group now called the Iran Project, going back to 2001, theiranproject.org, 844-295-TALK, toll-free to call the program, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. A couple of points here. David, I'm going to get to your email in a second, but I've got a question that I want to make sure that we kind of mine some of the concerns that the folks from the Iran Project have, which, by the way, if you're just joining us, Ambassador Pickering, for our listeners, the short mission statement of the Iran Project, and again, kind of the makeup of who the people are behind the Iran Project.
The Iran Project's short mission statement is that it believes that diplomatic contacts and communication between Iran and the United States are the preferred way to try to resolve the problems that are out there. The ones that John just brought up are certainly still on our agenda. Ballistic missile testing is still on our agenda. We have a long ways to go, and I would be the last to tell you that Iran is a perfect member of the international community. Quite the contrary. And so it allows us to look at a number of arrangements, talk to a number of people, but the idea is to promote a solution to those problems through the diplomatic effort that we can accept.
And these are primarily who making up the Iran Project?
Number of retired American diplomats who have served both in the region and beyond. We don't talk over the radio about names, although I'm not sure I'm asking a colleague here in the studio. Do we publish the names? We certainly produce documents that take positions. We just did one with 47 names on the list. I won't go through them all for
That's
you,
okay.
But I would recommend that you might look at that document on our website.
Bipartisan names and names with distinguished backgrounds and many names who our listeners would know right off the top of their head. Mort Halperin, Tom Daschle, James Dobbins, Carl Levin, Richard Lugar, Dick Lugar. So there's so many names, and that's just a small sampling. We'll get back to your phone calls in just a second, but again, it's theiranproject.org if you want to have a chance to learn more and read more about that. Herman in Brighton emails the program and asks this: what can the public do to influence the decision whether or not to stay in the Iran nuclear agreement? Or I think probably Herman, what Herman also means is whether to certify Iran's compliance or not. He says, is the decision entirely up to the president, or would there be any point in making our opinions known to members of Congress or to the State Department?
Yes, I think while the final decision on the executive branch is up to the president, as we have seen in Ambassador Haley's speech, she also expects that the Congress might play a role were the president to make a determination to reinstitute the sanctions, not to waive the reinstitution. Then the Congress would weigh in. So I think, yes, the State Department, yes, the White House, and yes, your representative and senators.
All right. So, Herman, there you go. It would be perhaps worth your time if you want to reach out in that way. Let me grab Tom in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller. I'm driving, and I'm going to pull over.
Thanks, Tom. We always recommend listen to the program wherever you are. Try not to call when you're in a moving car. But go ahead, Tom. If you're safe to talk, go ahead.
I'm safe. Thank you. I just wanted to ask Evan a question, and it's the ambassador's really eloquent response to the first caller you had. I believe his name was John.
Yes.
Who disagreed with the Iran deal, and the ambassador laid out point by point why he thought it was a good deal and why you know, he thought it was even better than he had expected. And yet nothing that the ambassador said seemed to be able to sway the opinion of someone who's got an idea already in their mind. And Evan, since you know, have your finger on the pulse of the public, what do you think needs to be done to be able to, you know, to change minds here?
That is, Tom, a tremendously important question, and I know the ambassador will want to weigh in on that as well. The first answer I have to that is I think you are right, and it's not just John, who is seems like a nice person. I've met him in person. He is a very nice guy. Mm-hmm. But yes, he's got ideas that are very hard to move. He has ideas on climate. He has ideas on politics. Those are very hard to move. My observation is that we have become very tribal when it comes to the war of ideas, and we are very tribal in our politics, and we are very invested in winning debates. We don't really honor the notion of being wrong or not being an expert. Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, I want everyone to read Tom Nichols' book. He teaches at the Naval War College, and Tom Nichols wrote a book on the death of expertise that I recommend to everybody, to John, to myself, to everyone listening, because that will hopefully add some humility to the equation. Mm-hmm. I am not an expert on Iran and the nuclear agreement. I want to listen, and I want to talk less and listen more, and that's why I hope people like John and everybody would feel that way. But I also think that to some degree, we have to go back to public schools, starting probably in middle school, but certainly in high school. We have to teach motivated reasoning, confirmation bias. We have to teach things that help us understand that being wrong or changing our minds is not a sign of weakness, and that there should be some celebration of that with new evidence, because I think we have done not a very good job of teaching those concepts, and so we've become tribal, and yet we don't have the reasoning skills to take with us to say, wait a second, what are my biases here? Me included, by the way. I'm the host of this program. We do 500 hours a year. I get a lot wrong, but I try to at least celebrate when I change my mind and to say, boy, I was wrong about that, or to say, I don't know. I tell my 5-year-old, if you don't know, say it, embrace it. That gives you a chance to learn something. So that's from my perspective, not feeling so weak when we don't know, or telling people when they've changed our minds instead of feeling like you've lost a battle in some sort of ongoing political war. So it's a culture change, and I don't know how to get there, but it's a great question, and now I'll let the ambassador come in, because I know these things matter to him as well.
Evan, right on, and I agree with you, and thank you, Tom, for pulling over and for a great question and for turning the tables. You gave me a little breathing space while Evan was so eloquent in laying out what it is that I agree with. I would just say this. This country has the First Amendment. The First Amendment is the primary engine of creating debate about issues. It allows us to have a free press. It is true that those who confected the First Amendment believed that people were able to make judgments on the basis of listening to debate and deciding what they felt was true and false. And my view is that the guidepost here has to be what's best for the country, not what's best for our party, or what's worst for the president we don't like, or best for the guy we would like to see there. As important as that is, it's down the road as a voter, as a citizen, you have the obligation to decide. Nobody else can decide this for you, what's best for the country, and exercise that decision at the ballot box. Today's primary day. It's being done as we speak. It's an important and indeed absolutely essential exercise in protecting and keeping our democracy. And if I can't convince John, at least John has given me the opportunity to try to talk to him about how I see the question. And John has quite, I think, likely and clearly talked to me about what he believes and sees. We now have to get to the stage of, okay, where does the truth rest? We're now in an awful period where truth has become relative, not relevant, where it's become essentially how I tell you it must be rather than how we see it actually as it is. And history is the great guardian of the truth, and we all need, as Evan said, to go back and look at history and to go back and see how and in what way we screwed it up and how and in what way we can learn lessons from that to be sharper and clearer in the future. But you've really touched a critically important problem, and I think you have both of our thanks for having done so.
Tom,
thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the phone call. I appreciate that. Call anytime, as long as you're not driving. And the other thing I would say is, especially since the election, we've had listeners call and say, hey, you know, this caught me off guard. Why was I so surprised by this? Why was I not open to the possibility? What we know is, in 1976, Jimmy Carter was elected, and 27% of American counties were so-called landslide counties, 20-point or more gap in the presidential numbers. In 2004, George W. Bush wins re-election over John Kerry, and 48% of American counties were landslide counties. Last year, 60% were landslide counties. What that means is we really are moving away from people who disagree with us. We are moving into bubbles, not just by race and socioeconomics, but ideologically. We are seeing that in elections, so force yourself to continue to go have lunch, have a beer, have coffee with people who you know disagree. It's very hard to disrespect them right to their face, and you might actually find them to be actually humans and not just aliens who were poorly programmed by their leaders before they were sent
and
here.
And thank you, Evan, for your plug for education in schools. I feel that very strongly. I grew up in a period when we used to study civics in high school. That's all gone. And those are the things that taught you the kind of clear thinking and reasonable understanding that might even help over a period of time to get John to take another look at this issue.
Let me grab another phone call. This is Douglas in Rochester. I'm with Ambassador Thomas Pickering. Go ahead, Douglas.
Well, good afternoon, Ambassador. The name Pickering has been very prominent in local history here because it was your ancestor, Timothy Pickering, who is the legate on behalf of General George Washington to negotiate the Canandaigua Treaty in 1794, and it's been called sometimes the Pickering Treaty, and that was with the U.S. government and the Six Nations of the Iroquois. And today, there's been a lot of activity by the Six Nations of the Iroquois to establish passports, recognizing that the Six Nations are nations, and that these passports would be honored by other countries, and they have been honored by other countries. But there seems to have been some ambivalence within the United States State Department about the status of these Iroquois passports, and I wondered if you could enlighten us on this.
Two things, Douglas. First, I'm delighted to hear from you. I knew about the Pickering Treaty. I was in Moscow in 1994 and invited to come to be your guest here for the 200th anniversary. And unfortunately, the government business in Moscow at the time kept me away. But I'm extremely proud of what Timothy Pickering accomplished. I'm not sure that the treaty is yet a basis for independent production of passports. But somebody should look at that, perhaps in a court of law, to see, in fact, whether that's not the case. I would love to see you have two passports, one as U.S. citizens and one as members of the Six Nations, and use them equally as part of the plurality and the greatness of our country. And I'll speak to my friends in the State Department. I happen to know a lawyer, my daughter, who works for the State Department, and I'll ask her for the legal basis of their refusal to accept your passport. And hopefully that can be opened and kept going. Thank you for raising it.
Yeah, Douglas, thank you for that phone call. Donna writes to the program and says, thank you for having such a distinguished guest. I have worked through the Middle East in Jordan, Yemen, and Palestine, and I admire the ambassador's work. My question is related to Yemen. Why is the U.S. so hesitant to engage in diplomacy to put a resolution to the ongoing conflict that is a humanitarian disaster, and how does that relate to our relations with Iran?
It's important. I think that Secretary Kerry, before he left office, made three or four earnest tries to get conversations going that might lead to an end of the conflict in Yemen, a conflict that Saudi Arabia got itself into, I think, on an ill-advised basis. I've been to Yemen. I've seen it, visited a number of times. It's a wonderful country. It doesn't need a conflict of this deadly character. And I think the differences that are there, political but also religious, between Houthi and Sunni Yemenis can be worked out and resolved. I'm afraid the current administration perhaps become too busy with other problems and too slow to staff the senior jobs in the State Department to pick up the cudgel here and try to work with Saudi Arabia, with the United Arab Emirates, with Iran, maybe even with our friends in Qatar, who have provided funding to help the Yemenis in one side or another to work this problem through.
One of the things that you'll learn if you go to the IranProject.org, which the ambassador is a part, is their concern of the consequences of not certifying Iran's compliance when it comes to the ripple effects, that Iran has a lot of influence and impact on a lot of different things. We could probably spend the entire day looking at individual nations, our relationships with them, their relationships, but we don't certainly have time to do that. I am curious to know, as a former ambassador to Israel, if you have any optimism about a resolution there. I mean, it's been so intractable, and I understand the pessimism a lot of people have. Does anything give you optimism there in the current climate?
At the present time, it is hard to get optimistic. At the end of the last administration, Kerry made a speech in which he set forth 8 or 10 basic principles that he thought should guide the resolution of this problem. In my view, they're very important. I was disappointed that the administration did not take those to the Security Council. They're in Israel's interest, and they're in the Palestinians' interest, and they're in the Arab world interest, not just to solve this problem, but to solve it on the basis of fairness and equity. So far, there are troubles in the leaderships in both sides. Prime Minister Netanyahu is always facing an election. He has a very narrow margin of victory in the last election. Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian operation, is split with the Hamas people over Gaza. He himself is aging. The Palestinians are not a strong negotiating group. So they're going to need help from outside. And I was delighted to see that President Trump thought this was the world's toughest problem, and he was therefore going to weigh in and solve it. It is the world's toughest problem, and weighing in and solve it is going to take a lot of time. But I admire him for taking it on, and I urge him to continue to keep at it, despite the fact that I couldn't tell him today that I'm very optimistic about a quick response.
Ambassador Thomas Pickering is part of a group known as the Iran Project, theiranproject.org, and he is in Rochester for an event at the University of Rochester, 3 p.m. this afternoon. You can go check it out. It's a great opportunity to hear someone with his breadth of experience. 3 p.m. at the Feldman Ballroom in the Frederick Douglass Commons at the University of Rochester. Mr. Ambassador, travel well. It is our great honor to have you here.
Thank you, Evan, and my honor to be with you.
I really, really appreciate his time and taking the time for Connections this afternoon. Just a reminder to you, live coverage of the primary elections tonight, 9 to 11. So we're right back here. We'll talk to you live tonight. And if not then, we'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.